Thank you, Larry, Christian, and the EPI for hosting this event, and all of you for coming. My work with Lucian Bebchuk offers a critical account of how CEO pay is set and the outcomes of this flawed pay-setting process. Today I'll be talking about the problem with the CEO pay-setting process and why giving shareholders more power in the corporation should reduce the problem with the CEO pay-setting process. So the stakes for shareholders in CEO pay are quite large. First of all, to the extent that CEOs are paid too much, it's money out of shareholders' pockets. Second of all, if pay arrangements are poorly structured, they'll fail to give CEOs adequate incentive to create shareholder value. And in some cases, they're structured in such a way that they cause CEOs to take steps that actually reduce shareholder value. Any discussion of executive compensation has to start with what we call the official view of executive compensation. And according to this view, corporations bargain at arm's length with their executives. The directors who set compensation bargain at arm's length with executives. The executives are crass human beings. They want to get paid as much money as possible. They want the easiest working condition possible. But the directors are guardians of shareholder interests, and they negotiate fiercely with the executives to try to keep pay down and to try to structure pay in such a way as to incentivize executives to generate shareholder value. On this view, the CEO pay is like a market like any other. And this official view underlies most economists' work on the subject of executive pay, and it's also used to justify boards' compensation decisions to shareholders, to courts, and to policymakers. Well, the official arm's length story is very reassuring, it's very neat, it's very tractable, you can make nice models with it, but it fails to account for the realities of the executive pay setting process. It's not only executives whose incentives matter. We need to look at the incentives of the directors who are setting pay, who are negotiating with executives. And there are many reasons why directors fail to bargain at arm's length with executives. First of all, directors have financial incentives to go along with the CEO. The way to remain on the board is to be renominated to the board by the nominating committee. Fighting with the CEO over pay is not a way to get yourself renominated to the board. In addition, the CEO has tremendous ability to favor directors, for example, by giving money to their favorite charities, and this is a widespread practice. Even apart from the financial considerations that directors have, there are social factors that militate against tough bargaining with the CEO. The directors work with the CEO on an ongoing basis. There's collegiality in the boardroom. It's hard once a year to turn on the CEO and get tough with him on pay after you've worked closely with him on other things. Directors often feel loyalty to the CEO, who will typically have invited the director onto the board or at least acquiesced to the director coming on the board. In many cases, directors were friends with the CEO before they got on the board. Many directors are also CEOs themselves who benefited from the current pay system, and so they have no interest in trying to challenge it. Finally, the directors are paying the CEO not with their own money, but with other people's money, with the shareholders' money. Warren Buffett puts it very well. He noted in 2009 that in the last 40 years, the CEO has had an important role in determining their own compensation. These people pick their own compensation committees. They aren't looking for Dobermans, they're looking for Cocker Spaniels. It's been a system that the CEO has dominated. In my experience, and he's served on almost 20 boards, boards have done little in the way of thinking through as an owner what they ought to pay these people. And this is not surprising because it's not their money. So the approach that we put forward on our book, which we call the managerial power approach, uses three basic building blocks: power, outrage, and camouflage. The same factors that work against arm's length bargaining give executives power over their boards, and they use this power to obtain pay arrangements that are favorable to them, pay that is higher than it would be if there were arm's-length bargaining, and pay that is more decoupled from performance than it would be if there were arm's-length bargaining. This power, however, is not unlimited. It's constrained in part by fear of shareholder outrage. If an arrangement would generate a lot of shareholder outrage, that will impose costs on the directors and on the executive. It may, for example, facilitate a takeover attempt, which generally is quite rare. The fear of outrage creates an incentive on the part of boards and executives to try to camouflage pay arrangements, to try to hide the amount of pay and the extent to which pay is decoupled from performance. In the book, we provide a considerable amount of evidence in support of the managerial power approach. The more power executives have, everything else equal, the more pay they get. The more power they have, the more their pay is decoupled from performance. There are gratuitous payments that are made to executives on their way out. They get all sorts of freebies, retirement payout enhancements to which they're not contractually entitled. That's evidence that they have power over their board. There is a considerable amount of pay that is totally decoupled from their own performance. And many pay practices, we show, are driven by the desire to try to hide from shareholders what executives are getting. In the securities laws of the 1930s, which were enacted in response to the crash in 1929, after Congress found out that many executives were paying themselves millions of dollars and even selling their shares short before the share price dropped, Congress decided to require disclosure of executive compensation, but they didn't say how this compensation should be disclosed. So what happened was firms would write 5, 10, 15 pages describing compensation, and then they would bury the amount they were actually paying the executive somewhere in this disclosure. Sometimes they would spell it out rather than put it in numbers, so it would be hard for people to see what exactly these people were being paid. And the SEC would give these disclosures to analysts and say, hey, can you figure out how much this person is being paid? And the analysts would come back with widely varying estimates because this stuff was so well camouflaged. So in 1992, the SEC decided to require every corporation to disclose the compensation paid to executives in a summary compensation table where the amount of salary was disclosed, the amount of bonus, the amount of long-term incentive compensation. This was supposed to make compensation clear and transparent to people. So what happened after 1992? Well, pay designers began relying heavily on forms of pay that didn't have to be reported in one of the boxes in this table, like supplemental executive retirement pensions, which until 2007 didn't have to be reported in the box. And then they would try to shift amounts from one box to another to make it more palatable. For example, salary had to be reported as salary. But it was embarrassing to report, you know, $5 or $6 million salary for somebody who was not doing a good job. So instead they would recharacterize salary as a guaranteed bonus and then report it in the bonus category, which made it look like it was performance related, but in fact it was guaranteed. So regardless of how bad the person's performance was, it would be reported in the bonus category. In 2007, after this came to light, the SEC made certain fixes to the table to try to better capture some of these payments, but it's an ongoing battle to try to figure out what executives are being paid. Since we wrote this book, backdating came to light. It turns out that there were thousands of companies that were backdating their executives' options in order to inflate their value in a way that was not apparent to shareholders, and the amounts involved were huge. There was billions of dollars transferred to executives underneath the radar screen. One executive alone, the CEO of United Health, had to pay back $500 million of extra value that he got from backdating his own options. The directors of that company told him, you determine the grant date of your own options. So he would look back over the course of the year, pick the lowest price, and say, okay, I want my options granted on that date. He got it. He got $500 million of extra compensation. All of this secret compensation, all of this hiding, it's very hard to reconcile with the official view of executive compensation, that there's arm's-length bargaining between boards and executives. But it is consistent with the managerial power approach. Okay, so what should be done? Well, we believe that the root problem is that directors don't care enough about shareholders. You can put in place as many independence requirements as you want, but at the end of the day, directors don't care about shareholders unless there's a meaningful chance that shareholders can replace them. So we should make it easier for shareholders to replace directors. We should have majority voting for directors so that if directors do not get a majority of the votes cast, they have to resign. It's something that's in the Dodd bill that's currently being considered. We should also give shareholders access to the corporate ballot to make it cheaper for them to nominate their own candidates to oppose the current directors. And we should reimburse proxy challengers who attract sufficient support from the shareholders to make it easier for shareholders to run proxy campaigns against incumbent directors. Directors will be more attentive to shareholders' interests if there's a meaningful chance that they think they're going to be replaced. So what we argue in the book is that if we put in place reforms that give shareholders more power and make directors more attentive to shareholders' interests, we will move reality closer to the official story of arm's-length bargaining that many people seem to believe in. This will improve executive compensation arrangements, and it will improve corporate governance more generally. Thank you.